Good afternoon.
Oh, all right.
Good afternoon. I'm Faith Andrews Bedford. I'm one of the panelists today, and our moderator will, I'm sure, come. He may be lost or hasn't found a parking spot or anything like that. Before we begin, though, I'd like to welcome you, and especially on behalf of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, which has sponsored the Virginia Festival of the Book for many, many, many years. And as all things, lectures, music, poem, listening to your children, best turned off cell phones. So if you would do that now, and even if you said, yes, I did it on my way, just check. Just let's all hold them up. We'll look at them and we'll make sure they're off. Mine's off. I'm using it as a stopwatch, but it's off. So as you know, the festival is free of charge, no cost, but we would love it if you'd go online and give back. If anything you've heard today or tomorrow has meant a lot to you, we would love to have some donations. Evaluations are on the various chairs. You may have received one as you came in. If you'll fill those out, that would be just terrific, because it helps keep the festival free and open to everybody. And we do have, as a reminder, books for sale. We have Sue's on the illustration, her topic, and let me just introduce Sue. She is the author of Creating a World on Paper, Henry Fenn's Career in Art, and she's a Charlottesville resident here, whose award-winning books about American landscape illustrators also include Creating Picturesque America and Shaping the Landscape Image, John Douglas Woodward. So Sue's book is here for sale, courtesy of the UVA bookstore, and Joy Kaiser, thank you, Joe. Joy is the author of America's Other Audubon, which is about a young woman who began illustrating in the mode of Audubon, and we are very blessed, and I know that Joy will tell us about it, to have some of her original books and drawings in the back, courtesy of the collections. And she has worked as a librarian for the Cleveland Museum of Natural History and the National Endowment for the Arts, and she is now an advanced research specialist for Kent State University. And I have written and lectured for about 27 years on the American Impressionist and sporting artist Frank W. Benson. I've curated shows and lectured, and am delighted to be here yet again speaking. I've spoken on a number of things. I'm also an essayist and have small collections of books called Barefoot Summers. I had a column in Country Living for many years, and there is an anthology of those as well. Now, I see, are you Michael?
There. I am.
Good. Why don't you come and take over? That's okay, that's fine. Good, I won't have to introduce myself anymore. But Joy and Sue, why did you come choose a place to sit up here? Or, okay, oh, you'd like to watch. I'm sorry, of course, because what's unique about this panel and what's so wonderful, since we're all talking about artists, is you get to see pictures. And if when the lights dim, you go to sleep, we'll understand. But it's just lovely. When I do book talks, I rarely have an opportunity to show images, and I know that Sue and Joy are going to have fun to that too. So I'm going to sit down. I'm going to hand this over to our moderator, who is Michael Sims and also an author himself. Here you go.
Thank you. Should I completely start over? Everybody's been introduced. Okay, wow, this is some serious power on this mic. I feel like Iron Man up here. I do apologize. I had a driver. What did I do? Is somebody jerking me around back there? I hate a sound person with a sense of humor. I just wanted to say a brief thing about the whole panel. What I'm gonna do is introduce each speaker right before she speaks, so that you can keep them straight and tell them apart. And I'm sorry, you already did that? You've done everything. Okay. I feel so useless now. One of the fun things for me about this whole project, and when they asked me if I would host this panel, is I'm a nonfiction writer myself, and I know from extensive personal experience how difficult it is to marshal so many facts and make them as lively and appealing and personal and human as these three writers have done in these books about gorgeous 19th century American art. And I think there's no better lens through which to look back. There's that academic word lens that I keep hearing at the book festival. To look back at the 19th century and to see a vision of America that is to me always cheering and inspirational and exciting. Because a great deal of history to me is very depressing. If you're just trudging through blood-soaked battlefields and religious wars and things like that. So to me, I turn to the history of natural history and the history of the visual arts for inspiration in what I want to write about. So we had talked about the three of you speaking in chronological order of the birth of your artists. So I have Sue first. Okay. So you've already introduced yourself even. Okay. I like their efficient expression here, which is, don't waste time, let's go. The fun part is that everyone here is going to have a lot of wonderful visions of art, so you'll know what she's talking about. Okay, please welcome Sue Rainey.
So much research, spent so much time, and it's fun to recall that when I had published my first book called Creating Picturesque America, I participated in the first book festival 20 years ago and gave a brief talk about it then. So, who was Harry Finn? For some 25 years, from 1870 to about 1895, Harry Finn was the best known and most prominent landscape illustrator in the United States. This was a time when illustrated periodicals were the primary means of sharing images. Before photographs could be printed in books and magazines by the halftone process. An illustrated periodical brought many new pictures into the home every week or every month, and was, according to a contemporary observer, the art gallery of the world. Single admission, 10 cents. And for fun, here's an 1873 Harper's Weekly cover showing the prominence of these traveling artists who worked for the magazine. This is called The Return of Our Artist with His Summer Sketches. And an image from an 1870 Hearth and Home showing the family gathered around the new issue. This is a small wood engraving blown up huge, so it has it doesn't look very good, but I liked the content. Finn was one of these traveling artists, and a pivotal project in establishing him as the leading landscape illustrator, Picturesque America, began in 1870 in the periodical, a weekly periodical, Appleton's Journal. Long after completing my 1994 book on Picturesque America, when I was looking for a new project around 2007, and thinking that I was tired of Finn, I found a 1901 Washington Post column using one of the wonderful new internet search tools that was written by another now largely forgotten artist, James Henry Moser. And he recalled the time in 1875 when he and another aspiring art student in Ohio pored over Finn's exquisite, he called them, and truthful drawings of Virginia's natural bridge, night after night in Picturesque America. And he wrote, resolving to see the bridge for themselves, they took a train to Lynchburg and walked the 58 miles to its base. Moser credited that monumental publication, Picturesque America, with generating, quote, the enthusiastic interest the youth of that time took in this country of ours and in landscape art. So this was a wow moment for me, confirming the importance and the significance I thought Finn had had. So then I looked at his almost 40 years of work after Picturesque America, which was all over the magazines and books of poetry, right up until the end of his life. For example, a process line cut, that was one of the newer processes late in his life, of this amazing ink drawing appeared in Century magazine the month Fenn died in April of 1911. And I want to point out, on the lower left, this monogram is his typical signature, an H combined with an F. So I say in the preface, in looking through my voluminous files, I found new energy and enthusiasm. Clearly, this artist was imaginative, creative, adaptable, indefatigable, and highly influential. His work shaped how many people viewed the world, popularized illustrated publications, and expanded the field for others. His story needed telling, and I wanted to tell it. Fenn was born in 1837, southwest of London, in Richmond, the son of a grocer. From an early age, he liked to draw and paint, and a childhood sketchbook shows surprising skill at about age 10. In 1910, a story in the children's magazine St. Nicholas that Fenn wrote, he recounted how a well-dressed couple spoke to him while he was drawing in Richmond Park. And soon afterwards, he received a box of paints from the Bishop of New Zealand. And he wrote that after the bishop had laid hands upon him, he felt himself dedicated to the work of transcribing the beauties of the world. So I guess you can read The Boy and the Bishop was the name of his story. When he was 14 or 15, his father arranged an apprenticeship for him with a wood engraving firm in London called the D.L. Brothers. And this was a good choice at the time, for the demand for wood engravings was increasing constantly. The D.L. Brothers provided instruction in drawing as well as engraving, and recall that Fenn was one of their earliest and very cleverest pupils. But at age 19 in 1857, Fenn wasn't ready to settle down with that firm or even in London, and he sailed for North America. He particularly wanted to see Niagara Falls. He arrived in New York just as New York was becoming the leading publishing center with ever more illustrated periodicals and books. Fenn worked as an engraver for several firms, including Harper's Weekly. And this is the only engraving of him that I've been able to identify from an 1860 Harper's Weekly. But I think you can see that the work that wood engraving is made up of tiny lines. The process was a relief process in which the engraver used sharp tools to cut away the whites or the voids, leaving the raised areas, often very minute lines, to carry the ink. And since it was a relief process, it could be printed on the same page with letterpress type, and this was an advantage that Fenn used to great skill later. In 1862, at the age of 25, he married his Brooklyn landlord's daughter, Marion, and not long afterwards they sailed for England. And there's a story that before he left, he told everyone, "I'm giving away all my engraving tools," and he was determined to become a painter and drawer afterwards. And while he was abroad, he went to Italy and studied painting and made some paintings. After their return to Brooklyn in 1863, Fenn was soon able to establish himself as a sought-after illustrator. His very first high-profile project was a special 1867 gift edition of Whittier's Snowbound, published by Boston's Ticknor & Fields, which was the leading publisher of American literature at the time. Fenn's tiny, nostalgic images opened the eyes of many Americans to the potential of wood engravings. One reviewer said, "They showed that there are possibilities in wood worthy of the attention of any artist." The fact that this book is often referred to as the first gift book published in America, even though it's not true, shows the impact that it had. So after the success of Snowbound, Fenn was tapped by New York's second largest firm after Harper's, D. Appleton & Company, for numerous projects, first for their journal, which had been started in 1869, and then the three huge books of picturesque views, Picturesque America, Picturesque Europe, and Picturesque Palestine, Sinai, and Egypt. And so these projects occupied Fenn from 1870 to 1882. So why this book, this focus on picturesque? I thought just a brief explanation. The popular pastime of picturesque travel, or travel in search of the picturesque, involved identifying natural or cultivated landscapes that conform to one of three aesthetic categories: the calm and peaceful beautiful, the awe-inspiring sublime mountains and canyons, or the rough textures and gnarled trees and ruins of the picturesque, suggesting the passage of time. So in 1870, Fenn first toured the South for Appleton's Journal and for a new series they published called Picturesque America, just in the journal. And his images of Florida swamps were exotic and extremely picturesque. This one is called Waiting for Decomposition. There's an alligator here in the water. Comparing his original watercolor of the old houses on Francis Street in St. Augustine on the left with the wood engraving, we see that in redrawing his composition on the woodblock in reverse, which is what the artist did for this project, he added a mule-drawn cart, an umbrella, a dog, and other things to make the image more picturesque. And this is what the artist regularly did. By 1872, the firm decided to change from the magazine series to a book in parts. 48 parts issued twice a month at 50 cents each for a total of $24. Then the parts could be bound in two volumes by Appleton or a local binder. And Fenn illustrated 24 of the book's 65 sections, while 12 other artists also participated. It would provide the most comprehensive coverage of the entire continental nation to date, and it would be extremely successful financially. It fostered pride in America's landscapes and cities, and it enabled citizens to construct and identify with a national image based on reconciliation of the North and South and incorporation of the West. Fenn's approach to page design made for more interesting and engaging pages than the traditional rectangle or easel format often used at the time, as in this 1871 handbook of Bible geography. And sometimes they were even turned sideways like that. Fenn often chose to interlock the lines of text with the wood engraving, and it, as he did here in this image we already saw of Natural Bridge. And in this view of the Palisades, so different from the familiar frontal view other artists had provided, here he offers the viewer a stepping stone from which to look down, and his use of the white of the page avoids the overall gray of many wood engravings. The Appletons built upon Picturesque America's success with a similar book in the same format on Europe. They sent Fenn to England in 1873, and although several British artists also contributed, he was again the most prolific contributor. Here's his portrait of himself and his wife looking out from St. Mark's Basilica in Venice. I love that he seems to be wearing the same hat. Picturesque Europe was completed in 60 parts by late 1879, and it too was very successful. Each of the three volumes had a steel engraved title page, as Fenn's view here of the Alhambra in Granada, Spain. A finished watercolor of an almost identical composition raises questions I haven't been able to answer. Were both of these works based on another unlocated work made on the spot, or did this one on the right serve as the basis for the steel engraving? The Appletons had long envisioned a book on Palestine and Egypt, considering it the most interesting area in the world and urgently requiring illustration so that scripture narrative could be understood. And they sent Fenn and his colleague John Douglas Woodward on trips to the Middle East in 1878 and 79, and the book was published in parts from 1881 to 83. Woodward's many letters provide a vivid account of their adventures and challenges, and there are not many Fenn letters, unfortunately, so I really enjoyed having this account of their trips. Woodward wrote about a tenting excursion. "Our tent is magnificent. We eat from the finest china and silver. It's a perfect hotel for two. We have 8 men, including the soldiers, and 10 horses and mules." That yet he wrote a week later, "You can form no idea of the glare and heat from these bare white hills, and at nights the braying of the donkeys and chattering of camp servants keeps you awake. Then he went on to describe the flies in the soup and the fleas in their beds and the thousands of children pestering their roadside camp. Fenn gives more attention to people in this book than in the earlier ones, often doing things they would have done, he thought, since biblical times. He also based it on photographs. So this is called the Shoe Bazaar, the original watercolor on the left, the Shoe Bazaar in Cairo, where clearly he added several figures, probably from photographs, to the wood engraving. He also introduced variations in scale, effects that photography could not achieve at the time. This is called Traditional Site of Bethpage, the House of Figs, and a distant landscape view is seemingly held by fig branches, in effect flattening the picture plane of the landscape and emphasizing the lifelike three-dimensionality of the branches. In 1881, Fenn and his family, now with five children, returned to New York after 8 years abroad. And the 1880s were really the high point of his career, and he soon found himself in demand for a plethora of projects with other publishers besides Appleton. In 1884-85, he worked with an architect to build an impressive shingle-style house in Montclair, New Jersey. And it was featured in several periodicals and books that attest, in my opinion, to his prominence. He contributed regularly to both new and established periodicals, especially the two leading illustrated monthlies in the 1880s and 90s, Century Magazine and Harper's Monthly, both at 35 cents an issue, $4 a year. An impressive example of Fenn's productivity is the January 1891 Century Magazine with 31 illustrations by him. From his travels in the South, he illustrates along the Lower James, featuring Shirley and Brandon plantations, and from his 1890 trip to California, the missions of Alta California, and this is his mission of San Luis Rey. Fenn's specialties were landscapes, architecture, and plant life, and he was a primary contributor to a series on historic buildings. This is Celia Thaxter's study on the Isle of Shoals about Portsmouth, New Hampshire, actually. And on new buildings, this is H.H. Richardson's Trinity Church in Boston. And he participated heavily in an important series on the battles and leaders of the Civil War, which worked towards national reconciliation. This is his ink drawing of Gaines Mill. And he illustrated the Chicago World's Fair and the other World's Fairs. In his late years, he continued to try new approaches, such as opening pages that combined his own lettering with an image. And this is his watercolor for a story about the Cedars of Lebanon. And it was reproduced as a halftone that finally that process came in. He continued to exhibit regularly with the American Watercolor Society. I haven't mentioned that at all, but he exhibited with it since the beginning of the society in 1867. He'd been a regular contributor. And this is his market square in Tangier from 1881, a Block Island pond from 1893, and a chapter of the Quran in 1898, which is unusual in its focus on figures for him. So I'll close with a quotation supporting my interpretation of Fenn's influence. The younger artist F. Hopkinson Smith wrote in 1892 that Picturesque America, as the first illustrated publication on so large a scale ever attempted, demonstrated the commercial value of pictures, and soon there were not enough artists to go around. If Fenn's efforts had instead been a dead failure, some distinguished illustrators of his day might have been measuring tape at Macy's. So Fenn had created a world that was overwhelmingly positive, full of natural and architectural beauty. And now, as his works become more accessible, the role he played can once more be appreciated. Thank you.
I love this so much. This is my favorite topic in the world, just about. I just want to take a second to remind you who Joy Kaiser is. She's been now at Kent State, but has been at the beautiful Cleveland Museum of Natural History in the past and numerous other positions. Her new book is called America's Other Audubon, and it's a beautiful book about a fascinating woman named Genevieve Jones, Civil War era woman, and her project to portray the eggs and nests of the many birds that Audubon had portrayed in adult form. And it's a project that, well, she'll tell you the story, but it's a wonderful story because she unfortunately is unable to finish it, and how it comes about is, makes for a fabulous story. She died before she even reached a halfway respectable age, as far as I'm concerned, but then that was the 19th century. Please welcome Joy Kaiser.
Genevieve Estelle Jones was born in her grandparents' house in Cleveland, Ohio in 1847. Her father, Nelson, was a country doctor who took up the study of natural history when he was in college. Her mother, Virginia, was raised in a household where the boys all went to Yale College and the girls were homeschooled by a governess. Everyone in the family enjoyed what they called dabbling with watercolors. Nelson Jones moved his family from Cleveland to Circleville in 1853 because the town was in need of physicians. Positioned along the Ohio and Erie Canal and surrounded by wetlands, it was notorious for its cases of malaria and typhoid fever. From the beginning, Genevieve's favorite pastime was riding with her father in the buggy when he went to visit his patients. Nelson taught her the basics of ornithology, and with the help of the family's English Cocker Spaniel dog, Arcos, they searched for nests and eggs and gathered eggs to take home for their natural history cabinet. It was on one of these outings that Genevieve found a nest that no one could identify. She told her father that she would just go home and look up the bird in a book in the library, but her father told her no one had yet created a book about the nests and eggs of American birds. So the seed for her idea of her future work was planted, and the topic of a book about nests and eggs of American birds was often the subject of family conversation. Jenny was homeschooled by her mother till she was of high school age. Then she entered Union High School, where she excelled in math and science and languages, but she was an artist at heart. She was a fine seamstress, penman, and china painter, an accomplished pianist and flutist, and a graceful dancer. When she graduated in 1865, her education was continued at home, where she was tutored in French, Greek, and German, and continued her music lessons. Her Greek tutor remembered her as the most adept pupil he'd ever had, and her music teacher eventually refused to continue accepting money for lessons because she was a better musician than he was. Genevieve's brother, Howard, was also homeschooled and shared his father's passion for ornithology, keeping a collection of songbirds as pets in his bedroom, and hawks and vultures, owls and kingfishers in his father's barn. When he graduated from high school in 1871, he went on to Hobart College in New York. While he was away from home, Genevieve followed his college curricula on her own. When he came home for visits, Howard wrote, "She was better informed on the subjects I'd been studying than I was myself. But still, as I saw it then and remember it now, there was something lacking in her life that gave a touch of sadness to me at times." Being nearly six foot tall and so much brighter than most of the girls her own age, Genevieve must have felt isolated and left out. But she'd found a kindred spirit in a charming, well-traveled, self-educated gentleman who was a musician and literary critic 10 years her senior. But sadly, as was often the case after the Civil War, he was also a periodic drunkard. Nelson and Virginia determined that the only way they would approve of the marriage was if the man could remain sober for at least 1 year. But he couldn't do it, and so the marriage was forbidden. Genevieve became despondent, and she was sent away to visit relatives in Philadelphia to have a change of scenery and to come to terms with her loss. While she was there, she attended the 1876 World's Fair, where she saw an exhibit of some of the original hand-colored paintings from Audubon's Birds of America. And she was reminded that even this master artist had failed to illustrate the nests and eggs of most American birds. I'm sorry, I'm having some trouble here. When she returned to Circleville, she had determined that she was going to create the book of nests and eggs that they had often talked about. Her father had never encouraged the idea of making a book because he knew it could be a very expensive undertaking. But now he felt so responsible for her still obvious grief that he just wanted to see her involved in a project that could take her mind off her sadness. So he offered to cover the initial costs of the book's production, and her brother Howard offered to gather the nests and eggs and write the field's notes. And Genevieve's childhood friend, Eliza Scholes, offered to help with the drawing and coloring of the illustrations. Genevieve and Eliza each contributed $100 of their own money for art supplies and began practicing sketching nests. Genevieve had first intended to illustrate the nests and eggs of all the birds in North America, but she was persuaded to begin with just the 130 species of birds that nested in Ohio. 100 copies of her book would be printed, the nests and eggs would be freshly collected so the colors could be at their peak, and they would be drawn life-size, the way the birds had been drawn in Audubon's work. The illustrations would be hand-colored using Winsor Newton watercolors imported from England. The book would be sold by subscription and issued in about 26 parts that Genevieve estimated would take about 5 years to complete. Each part would contain 3 illustrations with the accompanying text and be sold for $5 for the colored rendition and $2 for one that was uncolored. When 20 subscriptions were secured, the hard work really began. Those first drawings on the 65-pound lithographic stones were done right in the family's dining room. Then the stones were crated up and shipped 50 miles by train to Cincinnati to have proofs pulled. Those first stones made several trips back and forth between Circleville and Cincinnati before the drawings were satisfactory to everyone. But it quickly became apparent that the dining room was just not the right place to do scientific illustration because the lighting wasn't adequate, and the mounting clutter of nests made the room look like a jungle. So Nelson had a small two-room studio with skylights added to the barn. When part one was completed, it was mailed to editors of the ornithological journals for review. And Elliot Cowes, the editor of the Nuttall Ornithology Bulletin, wrote, "There's been nothing since Audubon to compare with the present work, nothing to claim an equal degree of skill or scientific accuracy." William Brewster, the founder and president of the American Ornithologist Union, wrote, "The nest of the wood thrush is a perfect masterpiece. I find that my eyes dwell on it long and lovingly every time I open the work and glance through its pages. Please accept my grateful thanks for part one of your beautiful work, and also my best wishes for the future prosperous continuance of a work that's too good to fail." Part one was mailed to subscribers in July, and the response was overwhelmingly positive. The number of subscriptions increased from 20 to 44 and included the names of Rutherford B. Hayes and Theodore Roosevelt. Genevieve and Eliza were quickly overcome by the sheer magnitude of hand coloring 100 copies of every illustration, so the number of plates to be covered was reduced to 50 and the others were set aside for later. But then, just as the book project seemed so promising, Genevieve was stricken with typhoid fever. She was violently ill for 3 weeks. During a lucid moment, she asked her brother to sit beside her on the bed. She told him that she knew she was dying. He tried to encourage her, reminding her of the dream for finishing the book. He had every reason to think she would recover, because in those days, 70% of people who got typhoid fever did. But she said, "If you want to, you and Lizzie finish the book, just as if I'm alive. Mother will help you." And the following day, she died at 32. The family was immobilized by grief, and the future of the book project was uncertain. Genevieve had only lived long enough to complete four of the illustrations for the book she'd been imagining for most of her life. Finally, Genevieve's mother, Virginia, decided she would take up the completion of the book so that it could become her daughter's memorial. Eliza Scholes withdrew from the project and moved to New York to pursue formal artistic training. But one person could not draw and color 50 copies of every illustration by herself, so two girls from Circleville were hired to color less important parts of each composition and the patterns on the eggs. Josephine Clipart, a Columbus artist, was hired to help color the nests themselves. Now, before this time, Virginia had only dabbled with watercolors and used her artistic skills to decorate her home or make gifts for her loved ones. She didn't even like birds. Although her attempts at lithography were tentative, she quickly brought her skills to the level of precision that had been established previously in the work. But now there were so many hands involved in the book's production that the cost of its creation was far exceeding the subscription price. But the book was completed in 1886. Howard had to gather the rest of the nests and eggs. Both Howard and Virginia were stricken with typhoid fever 2 years into the project. Virginia's eyes were permanently damaged, and Howard's heart was damaged, but when he was well enough, he went into the countryside to continue gathering nests and eggs. The book was completed in 1886, and the monument to Genevieve was completed, but the victory was bittersweet. The book was exhibited in the 1893 World's Fair, where it was awarded a bronze medal. Virginia Jones lost her eyesight at the end of her life, and Nelson Jones lost his entire retirement savings of $25,000 completing his daughter's work. But neither parent ever complained. They always said they were just grateful they had enough resources to finish the project, and they felt that their work on the book was the most significant accomplishment of their lives. The work Genevieve initiated and her family brought to completion broke new ground in the field of natural history illustration. When members of the American Ornithologists Union met on April 20th, 1917, to collectively celebrate the 70th birthdays of members who had been born in 1847, the names of seven individuals were noted who had not lived long enough to reach that milestone, but had still left their names indelibly impressed on the records of ornithology. Miss Genevieve Estelle Jones was listed among them. Thank you.
These talks just keep reminding me that it seems to me the humblest and noblest thing a human being can do is pay very careful, respectful attention to how the natural world actually works and looks. And it's produced some of the greatest imaginative works of art and at the same time advanced science. And I just think it's the great coalition of imaginative effort ever. But Faith Andrews Bedford has written and lectured extensively about American Impressionist Frank Benson, contributed definitive essays to catalogs, curated her own exhibitions about the topic. And her third book is a beautiful volume called Impressionist Summers. And it makes me think of Henry James's line that the two most beautiful words in the English language are summer afternoon, summer afternoon. Because some of these paintings are wonderful. And one of the things about him, like Harry Finn, is his versatility. He can move very smoothly from North Haven socialites summering on the shore to a close-up painting of an osprey catching a fish. And that kind of range is impressive in itself. Please welcome Faith Andrews Bedford.
Thank you. One of the interesting things about Frank Benson is that people tend to think there are two different artists, one that create this sort of beautiful, sun-struck, happy-go-lucky summer days on the right in an impressionist mode, and his birds, as you see on the easel behind him, and his etchings of them in another mode. Actually, when he was a young man, he wanted to be an illustrator in the mode of Audubon, very much like Genevieve was inspired by. And however, fortunately for us, he did that as well as pictures of his daughters. Now, here he is in 1897, but the precursor to that was that although we had a wonderful art scene in America, the people that were buying paintings really only wanted to buy European art. So most young artists of the day had to go abroad, and he went to Paris on his 21st birthday. His father gave him $2,000 and said, come home when it runs out. So it lasted 2 years at the Academy Julien. But in between, he went off to Concarneau on the coast of Brittany with some other better known older artists like this. But here's Frank, and here's his roommate, Joe. Frank was 6'4", Joe was 5'2". They called them the long and the short of it. And visiting there was his best friend, his sister's best friend, Ellen Pearson, Mrs. Pearson, and Katie. They were doing the Grand Tour, which is what young ladies' families would do in those days. And so they spent the summer as well. And Frank mostly worked on this painting here of a young girl called Gwen. And this was after the storm. What I think is wonderful to see is, although this was very much classic realism that was being taught in the Academy Julien here, but over here you can see he is already dabbling with white on white and the light on the tips of the waves and moving, at least in the water, into his later Impressionist period. This is his son George and his oldest daughter Eleanor on the hills of North Haven, Maine. But I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here, because when he was in Paris, he did one painting, and I love this, it's the only instance that we have of him practicing the high-keyed palette, the brush, broken brush strokes, evidence down here of some palette knife work, very evocative, misty here. The figures are not drawn well. It's just an impression. And that's all he did for many years. When he came home, he proposed to Ellen Pearson, but he had to prove to her mother that he could earn a living as an artist. And so, as many artists do, he hung out his shingle at a studio on his hometown of Salem and began doing portraits. Now, this is one of the very earliest, excuse me, let me go back there, portrait of Charles Hamlin, posthumously done. He was a professor at Colby College, and this is very much what he was taught in Paris, very chiaroscuro with strong light and strong darkness. But a little bit later, as you can see, he was now doing the Boston Brahmins in their ermines and their silks and satins, and his two little nieces here. And again, you can see how he's moving into focusing on the light, many different tones of white here, tipping the ermine with little dots of light, shimmering satin. So he's moving away from the classic academic style into something that was much more impressionist. But he was also doing his studio paintings. Fortunately, in 1889, he'd gotten a job as an instructor at the museum school in Boston, and he could afford to have a studio in Boston as well and hire models, but not quite yet. This is his sister, Elizabeth, age 18. Sadly, she died the following year of a brain aneurysm. But he is focusing, most importantly, on the light of an unseen fire reflecting in sort of opalescent tones on the jar and on her skirts, and then fading back into the background. He did a number of these, and it really made his career. People wanted more and more of these exotic yet light-filled works. Now, here's where he went to school, and here is where he practiced his teaching work. And here is where he lived, on the common in Salem. These were cities. They were dark. They didn't have much light. The air was bad. And he and Ellen wanted something better for their family. So they went to Mount Monadnock, Dublin, New Hampshire, Dublin Lake. And he brought along, of course, his children then. We have little Eleanor and George, and always the sportsman. Here's his Creole in the back. And this is Ellen, pregnant with Eleanor. And he's clearly under the influence of an American painter called Abbot Henderson Thayer, who painted women as goddesses, often with wings and halos. He, however, chose her to be the personification of summer. And some of you might have been to the Capitol at Washington and seen in the Library of Congress the beautiful murals up on the ceiling. Well, this was submitted to the committee, and they said, "We love them. Would you please do the seasons and the four graces?" So something rather like this is there on the ceiling, but this is at the Smithsonian Institute of American Art in Washington. So here he is painting at Dublin, or perhaps Newcastle, not too sure. There's Ellen and Eleanor and little George. And the thing that he loved, and as Renoir said, was we weren't able to go outside until paints were put in little tubes. Before that, you had a small glass dish, you had a little assistant, and the assistant was mixing your colors, and you really couldn't paint en plein air, as they would say. So this freed him to paint outside, which he loved to do, and then he would finish things in his studio later. Now, Dublin was a little too small, and there were also too many people fawning over him, wanting to meet the great artist. He went to Newcastle, New Hampshire, which is the tiny short piece of New Hampshire's shore, and in 1897, he began moving into his more mature Impressionist period. He described this as my first true en plein air painting when he sold it to Smith College, but said, I don't think I had it quite right. And I think you will agree the background is sort of muddy, and yes, he's showing you little broken brush strokes, almost like a halo. I would sense that Thayer's influence is still there, but it's not really quite right yet. And the following year, 1898, he and nine others of his friends, here we have Benson and Edmund Tarbell, with whom he ran the museum school, they seceded from the Society of American Artists, which caused a great scandal in the art world, formed their own group, said, we don't like having our paintings seen with lesser works. So for the next 20 years, these 10 men had their very own shows of just their best works, but many of them, J. Alden Weir, Thomas Wilmer Doing, William Metcalf, they were truly working in the Impressionist mode. And I can't help but think that this really influenced Benson, because the following year, he went back to Newcastle again. This is his last Newcastle painting with his, what her big sisters used to call the little afterthought, that's Sylvia and Elizabeth. And here is the dock from a house they were renting in Newcastle. And the thing I love about this painting is that you can see that while he was in Paris, the rage for Japanese woodblock prints was strong. And we have the high horizon, cropped elements in the painting, little bits of oriental leaves here, and yet the whole thing glows. And when it was shown at an exhibition in Boston, the critic said, it has the beautiful simplicity of a young rose. That's the way they used to write back then. But he was pleased with the reception, and a friend invited him to visit his house on a very remote island off the coast of Maine in Penobscot Bay. And his friend drove them to the top of the hill and showed him 13 acres of land, bordered here by a piece of water called the Thoroughfare, which separates North Haven from Vinyl Haven, and a house. But what Benson saw most was the barn, and what a perfect studio that would be. And so he was told that he could not rent it because the farmer had life tenancy. Fortunately for Benson, unfortunately for the farmer died the following winter, and Benson was able to begin renting Worcester Farm, built in 1796 with a tall chimney. It's a four square house with an addition here. Came with a boathouse and a long dock, and this was the start of his movement to the outside. He wanted for his children joyous times. Of course, we've got George, Eleanor, Elizabeth, and little Sylvia, and the dog Togo, who we see in a lot of works. He wanted them just the free, joyous experience of summer. And his very first year there, 1901, he painted Eleanor. She's 12. How many little girls that are 12 today look like this? It was a simpler time. but she strikes a pose that we'll see again in a number of paintings. This was immediately bought by Mrs. Gustav Radecki, who was the daughter of the man who founded the Rhode Island School of Design and the Rhode Island School of Design Museum. So that went up right away in Providence. The following year, he painted her, and when her hands grew tired, he would say, "LL, look into the shell." And people ask me often, what's the difference between American Impressionism and French Impressionism? I think this highlights it rather well in that the French Impressionists would let everything dissolve, the features of the model, the figure. The Americans tended to want to stay with the figures and close-up delineated, and then the background, they'd let that dissolve. That was fine. And so through his time in North Haven, I love this one, when it was first published in a little magazine for children called St. Nicholas, the writer said, "I think that he dips his paintbrush in a little jar of sunshine and uses that to paint his wonderful bright works." Now, if you asked Eleanor, who talked to her daughter about this later, "How did you all stay still on the boat?" She said, "We didn't. George was so bad, he rocked the boat and made us squeal." And so Benson painted a study of George and Ellen and Elizabeth, and then one of Eleanor, and joined them together later. And he did not have these boats in the background. But as Eleanor said, he always said that the most important thing about a picture was its design and its composition. And as I think it was Sue mentioned before with Mr. Fenn, Mr. Fenn would add a dog and a little burrow, and Benson would add whatever was needed to make the composition totally correct. That hangs in the Museum of Fine Arts, Boston. Now here's the little afterthought. And the only way you could hold her still at age about 3 was to play with this kitten in her mother's lap. But again, we see the Japanese influence where he's cropped the figure because little Sylvia is the most important person in this. I like the fact that he shows the laundry line. I think he took down some clothes so we could paint it more romantically. And the roses that Ellen painted in her, are planted in her garden so often. This one you may have seen before. It's the Worcester Art Museum. And we have Eleanor and Elizabeth and little Sylvia here. Ellen loved nasturtiums, planted them frequently, and I like to think of this as one of his white bench paintings because he often posed his girls on this in the orchard or on the porch. And here we see the island of Vinyl Haven, and they used to have races in their sailboats from one side of the thoroughfare to the other. And in The Reader, we have Eleanor, more grown up now a little bit, but I think this is wonderful how the composition is important, but you don't know it. He keeps your eyes moving from the verticality of the pickets here to the roundness of the umbrella, which continues in the roundness of her back. And then we have curves and softness, but we have the handle of the umbrella, or parasol, I guess it would be, and the squareness of the book to set it off, to keep your eye moving across the painting and make it more interesting. Now, it wasn't all work on North Haven, and his regime was usually to paint in the morning and then wash his brushes and play. This is a very uncharacteristic shot of him being at rest with the three children. It's probably Elizabeth missing, who's taking the picture. And he loved to carve as well, and he carved bows for each member of the family, depending on their height and weight and skill. And when Eleanor was at Smith College, he said, "This one has grown too small for you. You've added a bit of height. I shall send you a new one." And then they played a wonderful game. Let's see if we can get this to go ahead. Yes, called Fat Man's Bat Baseball. He would head a team. One of his good friends, Bella Pratt, a sculptor from the other side of the island, would head another. And the batter had to tie a pillow fore and aft, hit the ball, and run around the bases. And here's one of their wonderful clam bakes on the beaches close to their house, just behind their house, usually in honor of a special guest. Here it was Uncle Henry, who was a bugler boy in the Civil War. Everyone was very proud of him. Now, another uncharacteristic painting, but one of the reasons he did this too was that he wanted to see, would this make a good portrait as a painting? Could I make it work? I think he definitely asked Elizabeth here to hold on to the branch. It's oriental delicacy, its balance was fine. And you can see what he did in the next slide. He took himself out and put Eleanor in one of these wonderful Mandarin coats that his grandfather had brought back. He was a sea captain in Salem. Lovely embroidered silk, very textural. Here's Eleanor again reading. This might have been turned into a painting. I don't know. He did well over 1,000 oils. I know where most of them are at this point, but not all. So he took the photographs, which he would sometimes later use on a rainy day. Of course, Maine has rainy days. And here's Eleanor again in a study for young girl with a veil. But what I love is his absolute tour de force of showing you her features through the veil and just suggesting the veil. And again, these clouds probably weren't there. He put them in to make a better composition. Now, here's another white bench painting. And here is Eleanor finally finishing up. Now here's Summer 1909, which I think many of you have seen, but I don't think you've seen that he did, he pulled it apart and turned it into several other paintings. And here the girls are posing for it, minus the center one. Now here's the studio where he finished his work, and on the back you can see where he's cleaned his brushes on the wood. And here, on a rainy day, he posed Eleanor inside in her one of her lovely mandarin coats. And young Sylvia, also, she's at the Corcoran Museum now, an inside portrait, because it rained constantly. And one day, he decided he would look out the windows and paint what was all around. And here is what he painted. And here is part of that still left in the house. And here is Elizabeth inside their house on a rainy day painting. Now, his daughters began to get married. He lost his wonderful models. And so he began to turn once again to the birds that he so loved. Herons and lilies. And started in the barn at North Haven, the etchings for which he was so later famous. This is the side of the barn where he painted. And here's a picture of him making towering widgeon. And one of the lobstermen. And you can see, even with black and white, he creates light. Light of Ellen doing her hair at North Haven. Light of the moon with the birds that he so loved going across it. And he returned with his girls gone again to the hunting and fishing he loved. And George said, Dad, why don't you take watercolor with you? And so he did. And in 1921, he began a series of watercolors. Things that he'd seen off his dock in North Haven. Things that he saw just on the thoroughfare, a wonderful, fast-action watercolor, and some of the flowers that Ellen used to do, make an arrangement. She'd say he would steal them and take them up to the barn. And the birds that she would get, or that George would climb up and get as pets, often became wonderful watercolors, such an oriental work, just wet as can be. He did, up at the top we have wash drawings, in the bottom another wash drawing, again of his birds, a seagull done in watercolor. And as he told Ellen when she began painting herself, paint what you love and you will do well. And so his two little grandsons, her children, became the two boys older later on the same hill where their mother had posed. He loved to hunt and fish. He painted that as well. He loved to go down to the Chesapeake and hunt for duck. Watercolors covered that. And let me just move on for that. These were my two first books. The first one was the biography. The second one was for all the sporting art lovers who said you didn't cover that well enough. And at the end of the day, I remembered what was so exciting was realizing, and here I am at the Farnsworth Art Museum, and the new book is that came out 2 years ago when I curated the show, was that really North Haven is where it all began with the beautiful Impressionist sunlit works, his etchings, which started in the barn, his watercolors, which started on a salmon fishing trip, and which he began right away when he came home. Now, people ask me, and I'm scooping Michael on this, but while I'm here, why did you become interested in Benson? Well, here's Eleanor, who got married and had four little children, and then five. This is my mother. This is my grandmother. That was Eleanor. And she came, mother got married to Jim, and Ellen came to the wedding, and then they had me. And here I am with Benson. And here, the following year, is the whole family. Here's Benson and Ellen, their daughter Eleanor, and her big brood. So that's why I got into it, but I'll talk about that more. Thank you.
Okay, this is working. Can I get all of you up here so that we can do the discussion, Q&A? Because I was late getting here, I have a question. Who am I watching to know the time? There's usually someone in the room with the festival who's... Yes, ma'am. So you're going to hold up when we have 5 minutes left? Okay. How long do we have right now? Okay, 20 for discussion and then the signing. That's what I wanted to confirm.
That's for
okay.
You.
So if there's any doubt about your question, if we feel that the audience couldn't hear it, one of us will repeat it. In fact, I can presume to do that if you'd like me to. And I was going to start by asking, how did you all get involved with this? So let's, and your story, it's going to be difficult for anyone to top. I'm going to ask Joy to tell me her genesis story of this.
Well, 17 years ago, I came here to the University of Virginia for a conference. And I learned, it was for the Society of the History of Natural History, an international society. And I heard that there was going to be a conference in London on natural history illustration. And instantly I remembered a book I'd seen on my first day of work in the Cleveland Museum of Natural History. And that was Illustrations of the Nests and Eggs of the Birds of Ohio. There was a little label in there that just had about four sentences that described that the family had created this book. And I always thought there must be a lot more of a story there than it takes four sentences to tell. I wonder if a project on this family that nobody knows about would be important enough or interesting enough to be accepted in the conference in London. And that's how it started.
Okay, Sue, and your version?
Okay. is this working?
Turn it on.
My husband and I had lived in Switzerland, and we would see these little steel engravings in hotels and thought they were charming, and we bought a few, and then when I came home, I was wondering, where did these come from? And I learned that they came from books. And I learned that for America, a main source of these little engravings, or a little bit bigger engravings, was Picturesque America. Print dealers take the books apart and sometimes have them hand-colored and have them for sale. And so I also learned that there hadn't been anything written about Picturesque America. And so I had no particular degree in art history or anything, but I started researching it thinking I would write an article and just grew, and I learned that there were the descendants of a family living in Montclair, New Jersey, from the art person at the art museum there, and 30 years ago I met his granddaughter and the wife of his grandson, and now I'm in touch with their children, and I know relatives that don't know each other, different branches of the family, and so anyway, I just... As I said, I didn't know what to do back in 2007. I thought, well, maybe I'll write about his whole career, and that took a while, and it's been a lot of fun. But there's really not very much material except the prints themselves and the periodicals and the books. So I hope more will come to light now.
I have a one-year-old, and my wife and I are already telling him that curiosity is the magic carpet that you can ride anywhere and do anything with, and the great visceral, sensual pleasure of life. And I keep being reminded with all of these things that the reason I enjoy dealing with experts in various fields in my own nonfiction writing is they're all enthusiasts. They all started with something they were endlessly curious and passionate about, and very often it's a glimpse. It's seldom a wonderful family connection, which is an even better story. But it's very often a random encounter that just sparks something in your brain. I just love that. Pardon me, I have a cold.
Mention how I started.
Oh, please.
My husband took one of those job offers you can't refuse in New York City. So we both left our jobs at UVA and went there. And I thought, well, now what? And I realized there was a wonderful place to do research on Benson. And my mother had always hoped that someone would write a book on him. And so my daughter and I went to all the art galleries in New York City just looking for Bensons they might have had. And one of them said, why are you doing this? And I found myself saying, I'm going to write a book. And they said, if you write a book, we'll do a show. So they underwrote my 3 years of research and writing and had a wonderful exhibition in 1989. And of course, I had to go to Paris and track his footsteps. And what was wonderful was that his house was still there. But I naively thought that as a granddaughter, great-granddaughter, I just have to interview all the family and the book would come tumbling out. But if you think about what you know about your grandfather, the songs he sung, the games he played, you don't know anything about his history and how he had to climb the ladder. So I had to go digging just as hard as any other researcher. Harder, maybe, because I wanted to prove that I wasn't writing just a little reminiscence, that I was going to write a scholarly book. So I ended up doing that. Three of them, actually. Yeah.
And I think all of us have done our version of, we wanted to prove we're not just doing something, we're really serious at what we're up to here. I would like to immediately say, from most people I know, the Q&A part is the most interesting, the one part where we're encouraging you to surprise us. So feel free to ask any questions. Hands are jumping up immediately. Yes, sir.
Changed quite a lot, but it has a plaque on the door, on the front, and recently there was a blog about it. That's the way I got in touch with some of the other relatives, because the present owners are really excited about trying to take it back as much as they can.
Yes, ma'am.
To the same person, Ben is such an amazing artist. I'm just astonished that I have not heard of him. Before, are some of his
Okay, I'll get in the habit of repeating every question then. I thought it was louder than that, sorry. So her question was, because Harry Finn is so versatile and accomplished, why had she not heard of him?
There are a few works in museums, and especially at Montclair, they have about 10, but they're not much interested in, and I'm hoping they'll get more interested. There are some in a few other libraries, but there must be a lot more watercolors out there that I hope will come to light. And, the reason is that American art history, with the beginning of the 20th century, just changed to avant-garde and to painting as the most important thing. And, what I've tried to do is show that illustration also had an important role. And I hope that will lead other people, and already other people are looking at prints and illustrated works more than they did when I started 30 years ago.
This is like an auction. The woman just scratched her hair and I almost called on her. Yes, ma'am.
I have another question for the other Audubon. Since there are five artists involved, does most of the credit go to one of the artists, or is it, they share? I mean, because that almost sort of disperses the fame.
I'm sorry, should I just repeat that? I wasn't sure they heard.
I'm sorry.
The question is, since ultimately five different artists were involved in the other Audubon work, the nests and eggs, who really gets the credit and how has that worked out?
Well, really, Virginia should get the credit because she finished, Genevieve only did four plates. The other people were colorists, not artists. Howard did end up drawing the eggs because they were losing so much money that it was easier to do and it was hard to gather the nests. And they could put a lot of eggs on one page and knock off a lot of species on that list. So he wants lots of credit. He always said it was so hard to draw the eggs, but when you look at a nest, you think, really? You think, okay. But the book is about Genevieve, but the truth is that the artwork was finished by her mother. And I think it's pretty remarkable that there wasn't enough time to tell you the whole story about the mother. If you'd seen the artwork she did before she took up this work, you would never believe the same person could do that. I don't know how she managed that. And it should have been, the family always told me it should have been the ladies Audubon.
Yes, ma'am.
For Sue,
The question is, going forward from now, do you see any future in hand-done illustration?
Being done now. Well, I don't know what to say, because the publishing world's so turned upside down. Whether there's a way to... there certainly are private presses and still art kinds of books that are being done. And...
maybe children's books. We still have illustration
yes.
there.
Books. Absolute renaissance of children's illustration right now. Lauren Castillo and so many wonderful people. We have 5 more minutes to take some questions before you can meet the authors and get copies of these gorgeous books. I saw a hit. Yes, sir.
Actually, Benson did not like photography very much. He felt that it did not create enough of an aura. He felt it was just too realistic. So he used it to fix an image to help him on the rainy days finish things off. But he didn't realize. I would disagree with him. I think they're beautiful. Ansel Adams, wonderful photographers. But he just used it in a very practical way. And as far as some of his works being illustrated, his Geese Against a Sky, his men setting decoys in the Chesapeake, they were used more for books. There's one called The Concord River. There are some books of poetry that are illustrated by some of his birds. But his sporting art, having followed his Impressionist period, he carried that into it too, in terms of light, evocation, a quick impression at, say, sunrise with men setting out to hunt or fish. So, yes, he was an illustrator in a way himself, because some of his works were illustrated. I'm always looking for them and collecting them to see how many I can find. I found about 7 thus far.
We're going to sneak in one last question. Yes, ma'am. So the question was, what was the process involved in gathering all of the artwork to do one comprehensive book?
I think maybe Sue and Joy would agree that when you decide to write a book on an artist, you go to every museum, you go to every library, you look in every research archive you possibly can. Fortunately, Benson was quite famous. There were lots of contemporary reviews of his work done, 1898, 1903. I could find newspaper columns, and if I was lucky, there would be an illustration. Also, I think unlike their painters, he would exhibit in shows, and there would be catalogs of the shows. And again, if you're lucky, your artist might have one of those works illustrated. There were then early auctions. So they come up, and you seek, and you still seek. I'm sure that Joy and Sue are like I am, is I continue to look through Sotheby's and Christie's and obscure little auctions, Sloan, Skinner's, open up to the bee. Is there a Benson? Maybe one I don't know about. And so you, both of you, did you find that was how you got your material, just digging?
Yes.
Yeah. Anything you want to add on that?
I want to point out before I forget that the Special Collections has very kindly pulled some things from the collection of volume Pictures American, Pictures Palestine, and the Birds, the Nests and Eggs book, which is amazing that they have. So if you have a chance to look back there in that, thank you. Yeah.
Okay, I would like to do 2 things. First, I want to mention that the book festival is supported by the citizens who celebrate it. And please fill out these yellow forms. They read them, they listen to them, they do count, and it's your chance to vote. And the other is, please thank our participants today and join us back there to get a chance to meet them.
Off campus. But I'll see.